We read the Buddha's first sermon, and at the very end, we learn that one of his listeners, Gondanya, gained the Dharma eye, became a stream enterer. And the question is, how did he do that? Listening to the Dharma just once, how had he prepared his mind so that he could see the Dharma? The Dharma is basically expressed in the phrase, whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. Now, it's not saying everything that arises passes away. When the Buddha talks about things originating, the origination comes from within the mind. In other words, what is it in the mind that causes these things? And how do they cease? He saw that they ceased, and he saw what was left when they ceased, which was the deathless. So he gained a glimpse of the deathless, which is why that phrase appeared to him spontaneously. He saw something that was not subject to origination, something that was not subject to cessation. So how did he do that? What qualities did he prepare? Sometimes we hear that you have to let go of three fetters first before you can gain stream entry. The fetter of self-identification views, doubt, attachment to habits and practices. But actually, those fetters are cut after the experience of the deathless. What leads up to the experience of the deathless is a practice of four qualities. They're actually fairly basic. It's just learning how to do them right. The four are that you associate with people of integrity, you listen to the true Dharma, you apply appropriate attention, and then you practice the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. What does this mean? You look for people of integrity, and as the Buddha said, they have different qualities that you can identify that they really are people of integrity. One of the lists is that they have conviction, i.e. conviction in the Buddha's awakening. Virtue, they would not break the precepts. They develop good qualities in the mind. Generosity, they're willing to share what they have freely, without grudging. And finally, discernment. They understand how things arise and pass away, and especially how they arise and pass away in ways that give rise to suffering or can lead to the end of suffering. They also have to be truthful and compassionate. There's a passage where the Buddha says you need to associate with people for a long time to know whether they have integrity. And you look for three things. One, would they ever get people to do things that were going to harm those people? If so, you know they don't have compassion. You find somebody else. Two, would they ever claim to know things they didn't know? Again, if they would do that, then you find somebody else. And finally, is there a depth to their teachings that shows that they have deep personal attainments? If they don't, look for somebody else. But this is going to take time. As what I said, if you want to know a person's virtue, their good qualities, you have to be around them for a long time, and you have to be very observant, and you have to have integrity of your own. If you don't have integrity, you're always going to be doubting the integrity of others, and you won't be able to recognize who has integrity, who doesn't. So this throws it back on you. You have to develop these qualities within yourself. And when you do, you begin to notice them in others, recognize them in others. You know, these are people that you should go near to, and they should listen to their Dharma. Now the question is, what kind of Dharma is true Dharma? As the Buddha said, in the very beginning years of his teaching, the true Dharma was alive. In other words, all the monks and nuns were teaching the same way the Buddha taught. If you learned the Dharma, you could be confident this is the true Dharma. But then he said in later centuries, many other versions were going to come in, counterfeit versions of the Dharma, and it's going to call everything into question. So you need to have some tests for recognizing true Dharma. One of them is the test that he taught to the Gallamas. He taught them, you don't go by the fact that something is in a scripture, you don't go by the fact that something is said by your teacher. You put them into practice. In other words, these are teachings that have to be put into practice to know their true value. And see what the results are. This automatically alerts you to the fact that the teaching on karma is going to be important. The belief that what you do will lead to results that you can see for yourself. You have to have confidence in that principle, because that's how you're going to test things. There's another test that the Buddha taught to his stepmother. If you saw that by putting something into practice, it would lead to dispassion, to being unfettered, to shedding, in other words, shedding thoughts of revenge, shedding thoughts of pride, lead to contentment with material things, lead to persistence, in other words, you're not content if there are any unskillful qualities in your mind. It would lead to modesty, seclusion, and unburdensomeness. Okay, then you know that's the true Dharma. So you have to be willing to test things, and you have to be a good person. You have to become a good judge yourself, which means that you have to, again, develop qualities within yourself of mindfulness, alertness, ardency, discernment, so you can know what the true Dharma is. Now, having heard the true Dharma, then the next step is to apply appropriate attention. Basically, you're asking the right questions. How does this teaching apply to the problem of suffering? There are two main areas where the Buddha would say that these are the right way to phrase your questions. One is in the framework of what kind of actions are skillful, what kind of actions are unskillful. If they're skillful, how do you develop them? And if they're unskillful, how do you abandon them? Now again, notice this is a test that you have to go through actions. We're not here just to assent to what the Buddha says, that the world is like this, the world is like that. He's teaching us there are certain things that we do and say and think that will lead to true happiness, other things that will lead to harm. But all focus is on our actions. He's talking about the power of our actions here, also the power of our actions not only in general, but especially as we get onto the path. Because you will find some people say there's nothing to do, the path does itself. Or that you have to sort of just be with the awareness of things and let things come and go and say, well, that's the way they come and go. But no, the Buddha says there are things you actively have to develop, things you actively have to abandon. This gets into what Ajahn Lee says is the real factor in the mindfulness practice, which is the wisdom factor, i.e. ardency, the realization that if you really want to understand things, you have to commit yourself to doing the path and then reflect on the results. In other words, you have to do it. You're not just here to assent to things, say this is true, this sounds right. You have to test it in action. The same goes for the second main topic for appropriate attention, which is the Four Noble Truths. The fact that suffering is in the clinging aggregates. The cause of suffering is craving for sensuality, becoming, non-becoming. The cessation of suffering comes when you allow that craving to go away, when it ceases out of dispassion. And then the way to do that is through the Eightfold Noble Path. So again, the things you do, each of these truths has a duty. The truth of suffering is to be comprehended. In other words, to see, yes, it really is the clinging, is the suffering. When you the suffering of aging, suffering of illness, death. The suffering is in your clinging to some aggregates. So maybe the aggregate of feeling, maybe perceptions you have, maybe thought constructs. These tend to be the big problem. The way you talk to yourself, your thoughts, constructs. People can live in fairly comfortable circumstances, but the way you talk to yourself can make you miserable. And you're clinging to these things. In other words, you're feeding on them. You have desire and passion for them. That has to be comprehended. And then when you see the desire and passion of craving that goes into the clinging, causes the clinging, that has to be abandoned. The cessation is to be realized and the path is to be developed. So these are guidelines for things you do. The Buddha is giving you advice on how you should act. He saw that this was his main duty as a teacher, to give you a clear sense of knowing what should be done and what shouldn't be done. Back in his days, there were people who taught that people were powerless. For example, that whatever you experienced was just the result of past karma. There's nothing you could do in the present moment to stop that. The Buddha said, well, in that case, then there's nothing that would give you any idea that there was anything you should do or shouldn't do. The idea of should and should not wouldn't have any meaning. You'd be forced to do whatever past karma forced you to do. It's because we do have choice in the present moment that we can say yes or no. Think of the past karma, the results of past karma as food in your kitchen. And your present karma is your skill as a cook. You're going to have some pretty bad food in the kitchen, but if you're a really skilled cook, you're going to make something tolerable out of it. If you're a bad cook, you can get good ingredients and you can make a mess. So it was basically emphasizing the power of action here, and particularly the power of action on the path. There are things that we can do to make a change, things we can do to make a difference. But it is true that there are some causes of suffering that go away when you just look at them. Those are the thoughts in the mind that tend to hide out. They're like those little animals that hide in the dark. And you expose them to light and they run away. Those things go away when you just look at them. But there are other causes of suffering in the mind that don't. And this is where you have to do what the Buddha calls exerting a fabrication. In other words, bodily fabrication, the way you breathe. Verbal fabrication, the way you talk to yourself. And a mental fabrication, the thoughts, perceptions, and feelings that you focus on. And so you have to work with these things. This is one of the reasons why we do breath meditation. Because sometimes the way you breathe is contributing to your suffering. Well, you can breathe in better ways. Bring attention to the way you breathe. Bring attention to the way you talk to yourself. Here we have you talk to yourself about the breath. What kind of breathing feels good right now? If it doesn't feel good, how can I change? When it does feel good, how do I keep it going? When you can keep it going, how do I spread it to the body so I can get the most use out of it? And then finally, what perceptions do you hold in mind? If you find that you're angry about somebody and your perception is that they're a monster, well, they're not monsters. Look at them carefully. They don't have fangs. They're human beings. Change your perception. So there are some cases where, as I said, the causes of suffering go away when you simply look at them, when you simply bear witness to them. Others, however, require that you fight them because they're deeply entrenched and you have to figure them out. So I see that appropriate attention is all about having a strong sense of how to look at things, what framework to use, and then within that framework, how to decide what you should do and what you shouldn't do. For example, the duties of the Four Noble Truths. You look at the hindrances, well, they come under the category of the second truth, the cause of suffering, so they should be abandoned. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety and doubt. You can't let these things just stay in the mind and put down roots. You've got to figure out how to get rid of them. As the Buddha said, like a person whose head is on fire. Try to get rid of them as quickly as you can. Now, sometimes this does mean watching them for a while so you can understand why the mind is drawn to them. Because this is our problem. We tend to like our sensual desire. If they have ill will for somebody, we can dress it up and say, well, we're just demanding justice. This person really should suffer. When drowsiness comes, you pretend to be sleepy anyhow. We say, well, it's a good time to sleep. When you're restless about things, anxious about things, you tell yourself that you're being virtuous by worrying about the future. That's something you have to argue with. But there is a part of the mind that likes these things. So you have to actively argue with it. As in the case of worry. There are a lot of things that are going to happen in the future that we have no idea what's going to happen. No amount of worrying is going to make them go away. No amount of worrying is going to prepare us for them. But we can develop qualities of alertness, mindfulness, ardency. And these things will enable us to handle these things as they come up. As for doubt, there are two kinds of doubt. There's the doubt that doesn't really want to know, so, well, I just really don't know and I'm not going to find out. But then there's the doubt that wants to know. The doubt that wants to know is actually good. It spurs you on to action. The doubt that doesn't want to know is afraid to commit. That's the kind of doubt that you have to argue with. Again, you have to tell yourself there's only one way you're going to know the truth of the Buddha's teachings, and that's by putting them into practice and by making yourself a worthy judge of how they work. So there's some examples of things where you have to actually exert, in the Buddhist term, a fabrication. As for the five aggregates, those are things that you comprehend. What is form? What is feeling? What are perceptions? What are fabrications? And what does it mean to cling to these things? The word for clinging in Pali means to feed. What is consciousness? How do you cling to consciousness? We think it's just simply there. In fact, there are even some people who say that our everyday consciousness is unconditioned. Well, it's conditioned by the things it knows. It's conditioned like everything else. And we cling to it as a kind of food. You want to comprehend that fact. So you can start questioning your craving for these things. Are these things really worth clinging to? We might say, if I'm unconscious, what am I going to know? Well, the Buddha says, if you let go of the consciousness and the aggregates, there is another consciousness that will let you know the deathless. So our fascination with the six senses is getting in the way. So these are some ways in which we take guidance from appropriate attention in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Now finally, there's practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. Now what that meant in the time of the Buddha is you practice for the sake of disenchantment, you practice for the sake of dispassion. In other words, say you're practicing mindfulness not so you can get ahead in life. You're practicing mindfulness so you can get the mind into concentration so you can see it clearly and see where you're causing yourself unnecessary suffering. Because after all, the Buddha is saying that we suffer because of our things we like. That goes against the grain. We think we're happy because of the things we like. Like the story of the man who had lost his son. He goes to the charnel ground every day and crying, where are you, my lost son? Where are you, my little son? He comes back from the charnel ground, stops off to see the Buddha. The Buddha says, you look like someone out of your mind. Where are you coming from? And the man says, I've just come from the charnel ground, where body of my son is still lying there. And the Buddha says, yes, there's a lot of suffering that comes from those we love. And the man says, oh no, we get happiness from those we love. Here he is, suffering from the loss of his son, and he can't even see it, that it's causing him to suffer. This is the way a lot of us are. So there's a lot in the Dharma that goes against the grain, and we have to be prepared for that. If we learn to develop dispassion, we find that there's something much better. One of the reasons why the Buddha talks about the negative side of things in the world, he doesn't say that it's all negative. It's simply that if we focus on the positive side all the time, we won't get to see what's better. The second meaning nowadays, of course, practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma, means not changing the Dharma to suit our preferences. There's that Chan saying that says, the great way is easier for those with no preferences. Of course you're going to prefer not suffering to suffering. But the question is, if something is required to not suffer, the ideal way is to say, okay, whatever it is, I'm willing to do it. That's the right attitude. And that was the attitude that Anyagondanya had. He saw that he had clingings, cravings, things that he liked, things he was attached to, and that they were causing him to suffer, and he was willing to let them go. In other words, he was looking into his own mind, and he had the honesty, the integrity that comes from being with people of integrity, listening to their Dharma. So he was actually willing to let go of the things that were making him suffer. So those are the qualities that are required for stream entry. Associating with people of integrity, listening to the true Dharma, developing appropriate attention, and practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. Well, there's one more thing. When you listen to the true Dharma, it's how you listen. That's what makes all the difference. After all, there's other people sitting in the same group. There are five of them all together. The other four didn't gain the Dharma eye. They had to be taught more times before they were actually able to attain that. So it's not a question only of just getting good Dharma to listen to, but also how you listen. The Buddha said there are five ways or five attitudes you should bring when you listen to the Dharma that make it possible for you to see the true Dharma, i.e. to gain awakening on the level of stream entry. The first three are, one, you have no contempt for the teacher. In other words, you trust the teacher. Two, you have no contempt for the Dhamma that's being taught. You're willing to take it in, to look at your mind from the point of view of that Dhamma, not from the point of view of your old preconceived notions. And finally, you have no contempt for yourself. This is important. You have to believe that you are capable of taking this Dharma and practicing it. And then there are two other qualities. One of them is singleness of mind. Ekaka citta. Mind has gathered around one topic. Sometimes this is translated as one-pointedness of mind. In fact, it's sometimes interpreted that means your mind is so one-pointed that you don't sense anything, you don't hear anything, you don't have any awareness of your body. Well, this is obviously not true. If you didn't have any, if you couldn't hear anything, you wouldn't be able to hear that Dhamma. But it does mean aga there does not mean point. It means gathering place. So your mind is gathered around listening. You're not wandering off thinking about other things. You're giving full attention right here. And then finally, again, appropriate attention. Learning to ask the right questions about what you're listening to, how it can be applied to the problem of suffering in your mind. Now, there are other cases where the Buddha taught people who were able to attain stream entry. And he had to preface his remarks before he talked about the Four Noble Truths with what's called the graduated discourse. Now, the purpose of this graduated discourse is to develop those five qualities in the mind of the listener. The topics are generosity, virtue, the rewards of generosity and virtue in heaven, the drawbacks and degradation of sensuality, so that you look favorably on renunciation. They're talking about generosity and virtue, that's easy to understand. And the rewards of these things in heaven, the Buddha is basically affirming that those of you who are listening, the fact that you've been generous, the fact that you're virtuous, these are things that are worthy of praise. These are things that will give rise to goodness in the future. You listen to comments like this, and you realize that this is a person of integrity. He's talking about things that we know are good and affirming that they're good. There are people in the Buddhist time who say, oh, virtue has no meaning, it's simply a social convention. There really is no true good or evil in the world. Generosity has no meaning. When people die, they turn into nothingness, so whatever good you do to them has no long-term results. And you, by the way, are forced by the stars or forced by some other outside force. And the Buddha denied that. He said, no, you have value. The people you're giving things to have value. You listen to a talk like this, you know that you can trust the person who's giving that kind of talk. And he's also teaching you to have some pride in yourself, some self-confidence. Yes, I am on a good path because I've been doing these things. But then the Buddha turns the tables on you. He says, you gain these rewards and you go to heaven. But then when you get to heaven, the sensual pleasures there will corrode your good qualities. It's almost like samsara is a sick joke. You work hard, hard, hard to be a good person. And then when you enjoy the rewards, they can pull you down. So when you listen to this, you say, I've got to go beyond that. I don't want to fall for that trap again and again and again. And that's when you begin to look on renunciation, i.e. the happiness that comes from concentration in a good light. So this gets your mind focused in on the singleness of mind, that quality that we're trying to get so that you're fully focused on the talk. And then when you're in that state of mind, then the Buddha would talk about the Four Noble Truths, i.e. appropriate attention. So it's important how you listen. You have respect for the teacher, respect for the Dharma, respect for yourself. Bring these teachings in, apply them to the problem of suffering within you. And that's how Anyakondunya became the one who knows. Now there's some confusion about this topic, or the phrase, one who knows. In the Pali, Anya there means one who knows. And in this case, it means someone who's gained stream entry. In other cases, it also means someone who's gained arahantship. They have reached the true knowledge. But the phrase, the one who knows, is also used in the forest tradition. It has a different meaning there. Basically means the quality of awareness in your state of concentration. When you've been together with the object of concentration for a long enough time, then it begins to separate out It's like oil and vinegar in a salad dressing. You shake up the bottle enough and the oil and the vinegar stay mixed. But if you let it sit for long enough, they begin to separate out. And then you can focus on that sense of just what is aware as opposed to the object that it's aware of. Now this is a stage in concentration, and it's an important one because it allows you to step back from your objects and look at them from a little bit of a distance. As the Buddha said, if you want to gain insight into things, you have to see them as separate. And so there's the awareness there. It can be translated as awareness itself. Sometimes it's just translated as one who knows. It's basically your consciousness aggregate, separating out from the objects of the consciousness. That allows you to see these things as separate. Now there's some confusion about that. Some people think that it also means that your everyday awareness is also awakened. It's not. They sometimes say it's unconditioned. It's not. Sometimes the question is, how can a conditioned consciousness know other things than a conditioned? Well, it perfectly can. That's how it knows. It is conditioned by the things it knows. Even the state of when they're separated out, you maintain that separate state through a perception, the perception of knowing, knowing, knowing. And so, as I said, it is one of the functions you need as you practice. But it's only one. When the Buddha talks about the roles that you play in the practice, they actually come down to four. One is you as the person who's going to gain the results of the practice. In other words, you as the consumer who wants to do the practice because you'll benefit. And that's something he encourages. And there's you as the agent, you as the person who's responsible. When he taught Rahula to look at his actions, he always said, anticipate this action that I want to do, this action that I am doing, this action that I have done. You take responsibility for what you can do. Realize that you can make a change through your actions. If you couldn't make a change through your actions, there'd be no point in teaching you. So there's you as the agent, and there's you as the observer. This is the consciousness of the one who knows inside as a function of concentration. And then finally, there's you as the critic, the person who passes judgment on what you're doing. As the Buddha said, the Dharma is nourished through commitment and reflection. So you commit through the desire to gain the results and to the sense that you can actually do this, you can make a difference by your doing. And then you reflect by watching carefully, saying, oh, at least this is how things are happening. And then you can judge, are they happening well or not? Some of us don't like our inner critic. Well, that's because our inner critic hasn't been trained properly. We want an inner critic that helps us to get on the path, stay on the path, to recognize when we're acting skillfully, when we're not. So we have to play all four roles in our practice. Don't try to do just one. If it's nothing but wanting, 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 that's not going to help. Nothing but doing, doing, doing without any reflection, that's not going to help. If you're just watching, 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 bearing witness, nothing happens. A few causes of suffering will fall away, but there's still a lot of them buried in there. And finally, if you're judging yourself all the time but not making any improvements, that's not going to help either. All four of these functions, you as the consumer, you as the agent, you as the observer, and you as the judge or commentator, they have to learn how to work together. And it's in working together that's how you become one who knows in the sense that it has in the canon, which is that you have seen through all the processes of fabrication in the present moment, abandoned unskillful ones, and then get to the point where you even abandon skillful ones, and you gain a taste of the deathless. And this is possible. This is why the Buddha says, don't have contempt for yourself as you listen. It is possible to look carefully at your mind. And if you bring enough integrity, bring enough focus, mindfulness, alertness, you too can become one who knows.